Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio.
What up, man?
What's up, man? How you making?
Wait, trying to live outside like right now?
Man. You what?
Oh, I thought you were outside right now. I was like,
yeah, I'm outside, man. The basketball game on. I'm in New Orleans. You could do adult shit, like sit outside and have a drink.
I get the look at the flyer's face.
And he ain't even got no headphones on. Like, he just straight, like, I'm out in these streets.
Out
here. You got your headphones, Mr. Mack?
My guess is you just found out about this.
No, I don't like headphones. I don't like to be contained, man. I'm a wild animal.
I'm ready to fight Anthony Mackie, and I barely know him. I'm sorry.
See that? Welcome to knowing Anthony Mackie.
Let us start. Is everyone rolling?
Yes. Yes. Not Anthony Mackie, but...
No. I don't record. That's how they get everybody in trouble. I pre-play.
I can tell this is already going to match our drunken Christmas episodes. I can tell already. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Questlove Supreme. I'm your host, Questlove. We have Team Supreme with us. Unpaid Bill, hello.
Yeah.
How's it going?
It's Tuesday. Everything's good.
It's a Wednesday. Bro,
you didn't tell us that we got Black Muppets on the way.
Oh, yeah. Black Muppets. We haven't discussed Black Muppets. There are Black Muppets. Get into it.
Well, wait. I got to pose the question like SNL. Does that mean all the other Muppets are white?
Valid question. Can't answer that per se, but it's a really good question.
Are you not allowed to answer that question?
I don't know. I mean, probably. I haven't honestly thought about it, but it's a good. It's
don't
a good question.
Don't answer it, dude. Don't answer.
Are we recording? Because I don't record. I learned from Anthony Mackie. I don't record. I just
free play, baby.
I just free play. Free living. Free life. Yo,
so what's the Muppets' names?
Derek and Travis or something?
No, come on.
Oh, they got regular names?
One of them got a real black name. It's not real black, but it's a black enough.
Not like
Lil Derek and Lil Travis.
You got to name one of them Razul. You got to give him like a North Philly name, Razul.
See, Anthony.
Please. Anyway.
Wait, is your girlfriend of urban descent?
No, she's the producer of Sesame Street.
Right. Is she of urban descent?
What is
She's
urban
not.
Descent? What
is she
urban?
Black? His stepmother's Jamaican, though.
Oh, okay.
That's right.
All right.
Oh, their names are Elijah and Wes, which are not the blackest names I've ever heard either.
Yeah, that's millennial like.
Elijah's kind of, yeah. That's,
yeah, and that's they did Elijah. Shout outs to, you know, Elijah. Rest in peace, Colorado Springs. That's what's up.
Okay.
I don't know about that. My ex wanted to name my son Wyatt. And I was literally about to go to jail.
And
so you decided to name him
Anthony Jr.
Oh.
What do you think I'm gonna name him?
Yo, I that was the last thought of my mind. y'all can't see Anthony's face right now. He shot a look
question.
Like what you think I named him.
Anthony What's wrong Jr. with you? Listen. I'm from the South. You're going to be a junior. Shit.
Oh, God. I love me some Anthony Mackie. Okay.
I see that. Sugar Steve, how are we doing this week?
We're doing great. Nice to see everybody. Team Supreme, Anthony Mackie. So nice to see you.
What's up, Rich, man?
Greetings from Manhattan.
Laia.
Man. You look, I'm hype. I'm ready for this. I'm ready to go in.
Yes.
Fontilo. You've been ready for about 10 minutes, girl. Go in. God damn.
I'm good, man. It's going to be a fun episode. Let's get
All
it.
Right. Yeah, I was about to say, I'm going to eschew the long, drawn-out episode because there's really no need for this introduction. I'll just say this much.
Please.
8 Mile. Brother to brother. Manchurian Candidate. She Hate Me. Million Dollar Baby, Eagle Eye, The Hurt Locker, Notorious, Night Catches Us, Abraham Lincoln, Detroit, Captain America, Winter Soldier, Civil War also, The Hate You Give.
Yes!
I didn't realize that was THUG acronym. I'll get that later.
Oh, man.
Black or White. Oh, you knew that?
The thing is.
Yeah, I didn't know that, so sorry. Forgive me. All right. Anyway, the night before Avengers, Ant-Man, Striking Vipers, Black Mirror episode, definitely all the way. The Falcon Winter Soldier, of course. Dude,
What about the Matt Damon one?
Adjustment Bureau. Come on.
Yeah, Adjustment Bureau.
Okay. There was 12 more I was going to name, but fuck it. Ladies and gentlemen, we got Anthony Mackie on Questlove Supreme.
Yeah.
Yes.
And we're recorded. Boom.
we are recording. How are you right now, man?
I'm good, bro. I'm chilling. I'm just living life, man. Enjoying this unemployment game.
Shut up. Your job is on TV every week. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I'm like,
bro.
You're everywhere. Like, so how are you unemployed?
Well, this is the minute you finish a job,
you're unemployed.
Thank you, sir. There's one person here that knows how unemployment works.
I guess
there's
that's
one
right.
person here that also knows that you probably have five other things lined up.
Yeah. I mean, later, yeah. But right now, I'm unemployed.
I get that. You can actually file. He's right. I didn't think about it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I was told I can't file.
Oh. Well, I was about to say, you can file?
I don't get a STEMI check.
Yeah, no.
Yeah,
no.
I was going to say, you got your STEMI?
Dude.
You're a superhero.
I was going to file for STEMI, and they told me I couldn't.
Yeah, now that would be pretty fucked up of a country if we let the Falcon get a STEMI. That's income equality, like a motherfucker. Income inequality.
Hey, where are you right now? What part of the U.S.?
I'm in New Orleans, downtown.
Yeah.
So you are true blue New Orleans.
Yeah, Seven Ward, Boscoville, Hardhead. Know that.
Yeah, know that.
Anything else? Who that?
See, y'all
that.
New York motherfuckers don't know how to deal with that.
Yeah, we don't. From, you saw the silence afterwards.
Right. Everybody was like, two plus two is.
Love you too, Anthony. Thank you.
I was just wondering if all the New Orleans All-Stars knew each other, because we've talked to Terrence Blanchard in the last month. We talked to PJ Morton, Tank, and everybody is still, all the New Orleans folks are in New Orleans, unlike a lot of other folks.
Oh, yeah. Always. It's the best city in the world. Why would you leave? You get European flavor with the amenities of America, with the best food in the world. Why would you leave?
August.
Shit. Oh, you don't like being necky?
No.
Or,
oh, my bad.
Wait, what else happens in August besides the amount of hurricanes and floods?
I just mean it'd be on fire. Anthony Wright, it'd be on fire.
Yeah, you get in the pool and you get whatever your casual is, you wouldn't get in the pool. My neighbors know me through and through.
Oh, wow.
I'm like, stop looking over the fence, dog. This ain't for you. Stop looking over the fence.
I'm not going to make it through this, I don't think.
Oh, my God. All right. I don't even feel like having a normal-ass interview.
But he deserves his flowers, so he's like.
Flowers.
Yeah.
I think this is our flowers moment.
Yeah.
Man, for real.
I knew you too long. I'm gonna be good. Go ahead, bro. Go ahead.
No, you good. You straight.
I'm just waiting to get to this she hate me conversation. So.
Uh oh, here we go.
I do want to start.
That's what they call me.
What's your family situation in New Orleans? Like, how many brothers and sisters or siblings?
Three sisters, two brothers. We all live here. You know, once you're here, but you always come back. So, you know, and thankfully, knock on wood, none of us have had COVID, but I'm the youngest.
Mm-hmm. You're the baby. Okay. Are they all artistically inclined, or you're the only one that sort of broke the pack?
Nah, I'm the only one. They can't, damn. If you give them a menu to read, it'll be a disaster.
So what... What drew you to acting?
You know what? I was a kid, dude, and my teacher, you know, in the 90s, they wanted to put everybody on Ritalin. So, you know, my mom came to school and was like, yo, that's a gateway drug. And I was like, what the fuck? What is it a gateway to? So then I got scared. And instead, my third grade teacher came in and was like, yo, he's a good student. He just needs something to focus his attention. So she had me audition for the Talented in Theater program. And after that, I never had another problem.
Wow.
Yeah. Man. I had some amazing teachers in my life. Every step of my life, literally, I am where I am today because of the teachers I had. from my second this was, grade teacher all the way up.
And these were all teachers in New Orleans. So they had a, because we hear about music. I hear a lot about the music in New Orleans. But how, what's the kind of drama acting scene like locally?
No, I mean, there's, look, the acting scene is great. You know, we have a theaters here. We have theater groups here. You know, we have just the art scene in general. You know, if you look at the Mardi Gras Indians, all of that is just performing. Mm-hmm. You know, all of us are storytellers. You know, New Orleans is a culture of storytelling. So, you know, if you sit down with Wynton Marcellus or Terrence Blanchard, you see them dudes could tell a story that could wake up dead people, you know?
Oh, yeah. Oh, we had them both on the show.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, it's a part of the culture, man. It's, that's all it is. Storytelling is a part of the culture. So, you know, everybody here is an actor in their own right.
Your parents, what were your parents when you were growing up?
My mom was a housewife, dude. She just, like, chilled and spanked all six of us. And my dad was a contract. He had a roofing company. So, you know, he, with his education, became one of the most successful businessmen in the city of New Orleans.
Wow.
Just off of honesty and hustle. It's literally like one of the most amazing stories you would ever think to hear, from my grandfather to my dad to his six kids. You know, the amount of growth and prosperity and appreciation is the biggest thing. You know, my grandfather was a sharecropper, you know, so, you know, it was, you know, it's just one of those things where I would never defile my family's name just simply because of who my grandfather was. Like when I got in trouble, my dad used to say, you know, you were Mackie, right? So, you know, the validity of our name always meant something, even when I was a child. Like when we went somewhere, I was never Anthony. I was that Mackie boy.
So it was already a standard set.
It already was a standard.
And that standard seems like it has a lot to do with the roles that you seem to choose, too.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. That's why I'll never use the N-word on screen. That's why I choose roles in a way that people can watch, learn, and grow from.
Yeah, you do. Yeah.
When I play a thug, it's a thug with substance. I don't want to just be willy-nilly out here, you know, acting like an idiot selling booty for cornbread.
Yeah, we didn't mention one of my favorite Anthony Mackie roles. Is
wait, can we appreciate that imagery right there?
Yeah. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to step on that.
That was so much.
Yeah.
I've never heard of selling booty
for cornbread.
Look, I feel like someone in your life once said that to you and that stuck with you.
Yep, 100%. Yeah,
that's somebody's grandmother's turn. Don't be out there selling booty for cornbread.
Booty for cornbread.
My version of that was don't be out there in the corner selling wolf tickets.
Yeah, we had wolf tickets. That was our shit too. Wolf tickets.
What's that? Explain that.
Oh, you don't know what wolf tickets is?
Like wolf tickets, like bullshitting, like you capping.
Don't be acting a fool.
Wolf tickets?
Yeah, like, that's some Northeast shit.
Don't be writing no check you can't cash. You know,
sure, right.
Don't write a check you can't cash.
Bill, my dad was the type of person, yes, like. His goal in life, you know, like Chris Rock says, like, keep your daughter off the pole.
Mm-hmm.
His goal in life for me was just to keep me from going on the corner selling wolf tickets.
Wolf tickets. What's the genesis of that saying, though?
Who knows? You talking about, you want to find a,
we got
the
origin
of black saying?
Well, it's
we barely know where we come from. I'm like,
all right, we're recording. Let's
go. Sorry, we're recording.
Now I got to look up wolf ticket.
Nah, you know what it was. Some old black dude got a dog and painted him like a wolf and was selling tickets to see his dog. And everybody got mad and whooped his ass when they saw it wasn't a wolf. That was the origin of it.
And that is improv, ladies and gentlemen.
Storytelling in New Orleans. Making shit up. Yes.
The black history fact of the day.
Yeah. The fact of the day.
So
can I mention, Mr. Love, can I just mention why he's mentioning that role of playing thugs that just are more deeper than what you think? The inevitable.
Half-nessing.
No, I was just going to say, Mr.
P.
Yes, that was good.
Yes.
Sorry.
Wait, Bill, to answer your question on Urban Dictionary.
Oh, God.
Oh, yeah, the often cited Urban Dictionary, yes.
Wolf ticket, yes. To try, it's to try and sell a lie either to yourself or to others.
To yourself.
Oh, where I'm from, that's called marriage.
Yeah.
I'm happy.
Wow.
Let's go in, divorce. Wow. Let's do it.
Listen. Let's go in.
You know
this club right here. Yes, club.
All day. Let's yes, go. Club. Divorcedmen.org.
How long you been divorced, Mackie? Are you back married now? Where you at?
No. I've been divorced 4 years.
Yeah, me too.
4 years. Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah. Wait, you're saying never again?
Never.
He's talking to Anthony.
Sorry. I thought Anthony said never again.
That's me. My bad.
You think you'll do it again, or are you good?
Nah, you know what? I'm good, bro. Unless it's Oprah or unless it's somebody like, well, unless it's Halle Berry.
You don't need me.
No, I do. Or J-Lo.
Come on, look at their history.
That's what I'm saying. I'm like, it's perception. Wait, Anthony, what are we saying?
Your name is, your name is three of the most. All right, you're doing this on purpose. He's trolling.
That's my list. I want, if Kamala,
you want drama in your relationship.
You know.
Michelle Obama,
you know.
Yeah, but
the married ones,
you know, Cookie from Good Times. I mean,
who was Cookie? I don't know who Cookie was.
Penny, not Penny, but Wilona.
Okay. Yeah,
I think now, especially the age that we are now, I think marriage is just finding somebody that you want to die with. You want, that's the person you want to.
You know what? I think it's finding somebody that's nice, dog. Like, people nowadays just aren't
100%.
Nice.
Yeah.
Like, 100%. And you meet people, they're unappreciative. They're not nice. No matter what it is, no matter what you do for them, it's not enough. No matter what, they always asking you for something. Like, it's like, just meet somebody that's nice. Like, yo, I'm outside cutting grass. You look hot. Let me bring you something to drink. Yeah. You're a man and I love you. You know what I mean? Like, just be nice. Like, take care of me the way you don't take care of other motherfuckers. I know that's a hard idea to grasp, but just be nice. Like, you had a hard week. Yeah. Go out with your boys and, like, stuff. Yo, just be
that
nice.
That stuff was alluded. Yeah. Always-
but come home and take care of this when you finish with your boys. You got to, that's what you're supposed to do.
Oh, don't worry about that. Take care of that before and that. When I leave,
you see,
when I get home.
Go out and you have fun with your boys. You enjoy it. That's how that works.
Even have fun's a loaded definition.
Have fun and keep your dick to yourself. No, that's it.
That's synonymous. We're so old. Our idea of having fun is sitting around talking shit about the stuff we didn't do.
Yeah.
Drinking and having a good. That's it.
Shit. You know my idea of having fun is silence.
Exactly.
That's it. For real.
Yep.
Wait. Don't be offended, babe. Yeah, she Grace is away for a week and it's just me
talking shit.
I love silence.
Yeah.
I love silence.
Okay.
No, I just meant being in a relationship is, you know, I'm new. We're in the honeymoon phase still, so it's still like
still? You know,
yeah, we're still in our honeymoon phase.
Like, right. How long has it been? Is it 2 years?
I don't hate her yet. What is it? 21? 2 years almost.
Oh, it's 2 years, but one of those years was a COVID year, though. So that's like a year on steroids. That's like
actually,
5 years.
Yeah,
almost.
2020 like might
2 years
count
plus.
For 3 years.
For
and
real.
I'm shocked that we survived COVID. And so, you know, because everyone else didn't.
Yeah.
So.
Yo, they said the divorce rate during COVID went up like 1,000%.
Really?
Yes, it did.
Yeah, it's crazy when you actually meet the person you marry.
That part.
Yo, that shit changed everything.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's like, yo, be nice.
Be nice.
We gotta be nice to each other.
I feel like that's fair. Like, just be nice.
It is, but it's harder than it sounds. It's just
it's not. It's like really
for some people. For some people, yeah.
Yeah, for some people, you know.
Well, there's nice. There's also honesty
and transparency. You can lie to me. You can lie to me. Just be nice. Please lie to me. Tell me I'm the prettiest mom. I mean, please lie to me. Don't tell me the truth.
How am I going to segue to Juilliard after this conversation?
It's all lies. It's all lies. Juilliard's lies. It's all lies.
He's in the middle of a monologue, so you might as well
I thought this was the truth circle.
acting is a lie.
This is the true circle, bro.
It is.
Let me stop messing with you.
Definitely a safe space. Definitely a safe space.
Wolf stop tickets. Messing with you. I'm going to be all over TMZ. Anthony Mackie said.
They messing around
with y'all.
They don't pay attention to Questlove Supreme. It's too nerdy.
No. Y'all are trouble.
Yeah.
All right. So how did you wind up at Juilliard?
You know, it was a funny story, man. There was this actor from New Orleans named Wendell Pierce, and I met him when I was 14 years old. And when I met Wendell, Wendell showed up at school. He had on a white linen suit. He was driving a Porsche, a black Porsche. He had on a white linen hat. Honestly, I was like, that's the cleanest black dude I've ever seen.
Wow.
And he gave a speech, and I went up to him afterwards, and I was like, yo, whatever you did, I'm going to do. Wherever you went, I'm going to go. He goes, all right, youngster, go sit down. I'm like, all right, bet. So I went to North Carolina School of the Arts. He went to NOCA, I went to NOCA. He went to Juilliard, I went to Juilliard. I went there just specifically because he went there, because he was such a role model and an ambassador to the arts for me, just because he was such a talented dude. And I had never seen a black dude speak so eloquently, a black dude so like emotionally connected with his work. You know what I mean? Like the stuff that he was the best part about Waiting to Exhale.
Yeah.
And he had two scenes.
Yeah, true that. And you know wait, what I mean? And then y'all both ended up in She Hate Me together.
Exactly.
That means she just wants to rush to She Hate.
No, I don't. I was just saying, we'll go back to that. You know, put a pin in it. But I just thought that
was... Well, see, now you said that, Aunt, and now I'm thinking, shit. So that made an impression. So you're saying that seeing Wendell in his clean suit and his Porsche, that made an impression on you, and you were like, that's what I want to do?
No, it was seeing him so clean, because I didn't even know he had the Porsche until I looked out the window, and I'm not a Porsche dude. Like, if he had pulled up in a classic Mustang, I would have been like, this guy is God, you know? But seeing him speak about the arts and the way his passion about the arts and him being so clean, like, you know, my dad was a contractor, man. My dad was a roofer. Every day my dad came home, he got his, I mean, he was... Like, I had never seen a dude that clean before, you know, and it really changed my perception of what a man was, because to me, a man was a dude who went out and had dirt under his nails and, you know, bust his ass for his family and really made sure that his house was in order. And I didn't know. I thought only white dudes could do that in a suit.
Mm. Wow.
Gotcha. See, now, damn, Aunt, you said that. Now I'm all messed up, because whenever I go to Philly.
Yeah.
I purposely try to do the opposite. Like, I drive the bummy car and
the Kia Soul.
No, because I'm trying to do this down to earth blue collar musician thing, and I thought that would make more of an impression than, you know.
I think what's interesting, especially with kids want to see. That's why, like, people in, you know, everybody in the music industry and everybody who kids try to emulate, they try to emulate them because they look like they got it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm.
That's why, you know, little girls are asking for these, you know, drag queen eyelashes, and because, you know, that's the idea now, because I think that's the look of when you got it. You know, and my thing was, my dad had it, but when I looked at Wendell, like, I saw Wendell and he had it. Well, you know, his education level, you know, everything about him, dude, like, to this day, like, I talked to him last week before he left for Europe, and everything about this dude just exudes confidence and success.
That's so dope.
You know?
Man. Yeah.
Like, yeah. If there's a generation of Latinx, he's Black X.
No, you're right. He definitely needs to get more flowers out loud. You're right.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
100%.
Can I ask you about that class of Juilliard? Because it's interesting. It seems like there's a slew of folks that came out of Juilliard from your year and, like, either the following or the pre. Like, from I was thinking about Nelson Ellis from True Blood to my girl from Power, Lauren. You know what I mean? Like, so can you talk about that? And if y'all connected and ever circle back in life?
I mean, of course. You know, the great thing about it is our class was probably the first, well, I would say definitely
Rutina,
the first.
I'm sorry, yes.
Yeah, Rutina Wesley. Our class was definitely the first diverse class at Juilliard. We had 5 Black people. We had a Native American. We had an Asian. We, I mean, 20 people, you know, 8 of us were from ethnic descent, you know? That's so dope. We were definitely the first and the most diverse class at Juilliard ever. And because of that, we were able to do things that other classes weren't able to do. Like, I first got recognition by playing Tupac off Broadway. And that was a play we developed at Juilliard. You know, we did that play at Juilliard first because it was in the New York Times. You know, who would expect Juilliard students to be able to do a play about Tupac? And I'm like, so why is acting the only career where you're limited by your level of education?
Like, the more that you have, the less kind of roles.
No. The more you have, the less Black you are.
The less Black you are. Thank you.
Yeah, go ahead and say it. The less Black you are. Yeah. And that's the problem. That's the whole situation.
Ooh,
that's the whole situation that really confuses me. You know, if you're a Black person with any substance, depth, and weight, you're looked upon as fake, phony, or not Black. That's crazy. There's been times when I've gone in auditions and they're like, yeah, you ain't Black. You went to Juilliard. Won't say the person's name who told me that, but you know, that's happened to me a few times in my career, you know, but we don't look at it that way. And that's the sad, scary part. If you went to Juilliard, nah, you're not real. We got to go get somebody that shot 17 people and can actually smoke weed on set.
Well, yeah, some of them commercials mess that up. When you see the commercials where the people are speaking that urban thing and then they do the behind the scenes and they're speaking proper. And you're like, so I think those kind of, yeah.
Black acting school.
Oh, and Hollywood Shuffle.
Can you talk about, well, before you started 8 Mile, you were in a string of August Wilson plays.
Yes.
Was that just strictly for, how did you get involved in those projects? Were they Juilliard related or was this off-Broadway?
No, that was just out of love for August. I mean, you know, Piano Lesson was one of the first plays I saw, and it literally changed my life. It changed my relationship with my father because I didn't understand him until I saw Piano Lesson. You know, so August was a dear friend and someone who had a lasting impact on my life. And that's why I named my third son August, because of, you know, his inability to conceive. You know, I mean, he did something no other writer on earth has done. He documented a culture of people for 100 years. And nobody gives him props. Nobody talks about it. You know, it's heartbreaking. At the same time, you know, that's our fault. Yeah. So
folks,
you know,
give him props. Folks give him props, but maybe not enough. Maybe he's not utilized enough.
I mean, they gave him a stamp.
But it depends on what you feel like props are. If you feel like, do you feel like the Black community knows who he is? Do you feel like the world should know? And the world does know, but the theater world knows. It's kind of, it's interesting in that way, because I'm like, I feel like August Wilson has been a part of the conversation for quite a while now, depending on who you're talking to.
He's been a part of the conversation now for, I would say, the past.
Okay.
Since
of my
Piano Lesson. Since, okay. No. Since Denzel Fences. And Viola.
Yeah. Fences.
Then
true.
All of a sudden, it's like, oh, we need to read this book. Oh, this should be required reading. Oh, we should. And it's like, you know, when he was alive, nobody gave him that. They have been trying to make Fences a movie when he was alive.
Yeah. You're right.
You know what I mean? So he deserves that, man. He deserves, you know, for all 10 of his plays to be done.
What was it about the Piano Lesson that helped you understand your dad?
I never realized the day-to-day struggles and hardships of a Black man once he left the house to the time he got back to the house.
Yeah.
You know, my dad had to beg, borrow, steal, fight, and kill to make sure our roof was over our head as kids. And then he had to come home and deal with us. Out there was 6 of us and my mom and whoever else was in the house, you know. And I always thought he was just a mean old dude. I always thought he was just a detached old dude. But no, a month. Like, I always wondered why my dad would pull up to the house and sit in his truck for 30 minutes before coming inside.
Man, listen.
Listen.
I do it to this day. I do it.
Right.
The Black man driveway sitting.
Oh, I'm doing it right now.
That is a real thing.
I thought it was only one loan. Like,
it's the real thing.
Sometimes you just got to sit in your car for 25 minutes so you can
just chill out.
I literally thought that was just me.
No, that is us.
You are not alone, bro. That is us.
That is us. And I never got that until I saw Fences. When I saw, you know, what Troy Maxim had to go through, the hardships and decay that he had suffered, the experience and bastardizing of his masculinity he went through every day. And then he had to come home and deal with his family.
His family had to come and deal with him.
100%.
That's not a black man.
But that's a byproduct of everything that he had to go through.
Yes.
Day.
I thought about that when you were talking about your father and Wendell Pierce, and I was like, you know, not for nothing, it's a privilege, and even in 2021, depending on how old you are, it's a privilege to be like emotionally evolved, and all black men didn't have that privilege. And I thought about your dad, and I was like, your dad really didn't have the privilege that Wendell had to be vulnerable, to show emotion, to do the things that required for, you know, for acting and things.
My dad, like I said, my dad got kicked out of school in eighth grade. Like, my dad, you know, was born in the 40s, so it was a different time.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't, you know, Benjamin E. Mays, who was the president of Morehouse College, said our grandparents studied agriculture so that our parents can study math and science so that we can study arts and literature.
Mm-hmm, philosophy, right.
My grandfather, and now think about that. My grandfather was a sharecropper, my daddy was a contractor, and I'm a fucking actor. That's lineage, dog. My dad took bullets, and my dad took so much shit just so I can sit here and be a goofy dude, a fucking actor. Just so I can sit around and taste the coffee in a classroom. You know what I mean?
It's just,
when you look at it that way, I can't get in no movie and start talking about N-word this, N-word that. I can't get in no movie and jeopardize the legacy of my dad and my grandfather and everything they put into me. Hell no. You can't do that. Yeah. That's why when I see these t-shirts, you know, I am not my ancestors, #like, these hands.
Right. I'm like,
what? What else t-shirts at?
I see them online. It's corny. It's fucking corny.
I am not my ancestors. That is #like the opposite of what black people should be saying. That's
100%. 100%. But I mean, that's a generational thing, you know.
Yeah.
Eyelashes and hookahs. Is that what I call it?
How old is your oldest kid, Anthony?
58.
Okay, that's fine. Because I know you're dealing with it. Whatever the age is.
All day, every day. All day.
TikTok.
I get it. My oldest kid, he's 11. I thought you said my oldest sibling.
Oh, no. Okay, I thought you was joking and you didn't want to tell me.
Oh, no. He's 11.
Okay, we good. He's 11. Okay, me and you, we cool. Okay.
Oh, girl.
Oh, so before y'all weren't cool when
he was right.
being passive aggressive?
Exactly.
Damn. I just that fast.
So, Aunt, when you came to New York, when did you officially start pounding the pavement as far as auditions are concerned with movies? Like, at what point did you decide, like, okay, I should get an agent, I should do movies?
Nah, you know, going to Juilliard, to be honest, the agents come to us.
Oh, I bet.
We have auditions and they invite all the agents.
Is there an active draft? I was about to say, what does it look like?
She's throwing shots, huh?
No, this is, I'm really.
No, we're serious.
Seriously fascinated by Juilliard and especially all the talent.
I got accepted to Juilliard and couldn't afford to go, so I'm kind of like vicariously living through you right now.
Well, I think you did all right.
Thank you.
So you're saying that already agents come to see like who's...
Yeah, we do something called the consortium audition, and basically you prepare two scenes and they pair you up with someone, and the agents come. They watch the scenes, and then we do a repertory season. So the agents come, if they're interested in you and they watch your plays in the repertory season, that's when you get a meeting with whatever agent is interested in you. Now, the interesting thing is some people get no agents and some people get all the agents.
Wow.
Gotcha.
So, you know, and then there are the people in between. I was one of those like in between people. I didn't have a bunch of agents, but I didn't have no agents. But the agent that I got with, you know, in 2001. That's the same person.
Okay.
That's what's up. What is it about? One thing I always wanted to know, what is it about Juilliard that makes it such a great school? And like, what did you learn? What are some of the things you learned there about acting that you still apply to your career today?
You know, the great thing about Juilliard was at that time, there was no technique. Like, we didn't study Meisner. We didn't study any of the acting techniques. We literally, they developed a curriculum where you built your character from yourself and your life experiences. Then you layer things on that character through movement. Then you layer things on that character as far as the way he talks. Then you layer things, physicality onto that character, you know, prosthetics, hair, wardrobe, whatever. And then when you look in the mirror, it's a completely different person because he moves different, he sounds different, he acts different than you do. It was never an idea of technique, you know, because if you go to school from now and your second year in, you realize Meisner doesn't work for you. You have to start over. But if you start from yourself, you build from yourself, you'll always be able to create an honest character because you started with yourself.
Yeah, it's coming from you.
Yeah, gotcha. It was, you know, and that's why you can always tell when motherfuckers are acting. Like when you saw Bernie Mac in Life, he wasn't acting. He was that dude. You know, but there's certain other people.
He was jangling.
You know, there were certain other people who tried to imitate that, and you can tell they were acting because they had no substance and background with that hair.
Yeah.
You know?
Damn.
So when you get a role, do you have to go through that process where you write a 6-page biography of what your character was? And, you know, it's like I heard the exercise of writing a complete biography of what your character was born, its family.
Nobody do that shit.
Questlove Supreme is the show that where everyone just knocks the bowling pins down.
I love it. Ain't nobody got time for that shit, man.
Nobody got time for 6 pages, motherfucker. I'm out here.
6 pages.
I'm going to pay for the act.
Like, I barely graduated high school. You know, I don't want you to take me to write 6 pages.
ACK. Motherfucker, I came here to act. Shit. Writing all these goddamn thesis statements and shit.
Right, a motherfucking yeah. Hollis Opus in this bitch.
No, I've heard actors do that though, so you don't.
Some do. For me, it's different. The first thing I do is I read the script and I break it down three ways because life is about perception. It's not about how you act, it's about how people perceive your act. So if I say it and I meant it sincerely, but you perceive it as sarcasm, your feelings are hurt, but I meant it sincerely. So even though I was trying to be nice, it don't matter. You took it as me being an asshole. So now in that reality, I'm an asshole because that's your perception.
Impact right? versus intent.
So gotcha. There you go. So that being said, when I get a script, I read it in three different perspectives. First, when I get a script, I tell my agents, don't tell me who I'm playing because, you know, I want to read the script for the story. If the story don't work, if the characters don't work, I'm not doing it. So when you read a script, you read it from the perspective of the writer, which no character delineage is involved. Read it from the perspective of your character. And then you read it from the perspective of the other characters talking about you. And you highlight your three different colors. Because then you know if you're walking down the street and you're like, you know, you walk up to a girl and you're like, hey, how you doing? That's when while you're walking down the street, they cut to two girls across the street. And they're like, look at that old goofy motherfucker walking down the street. So, you know, you walking goofy. You don't look cool. You look goofy.
Right.
So that affects the way you walk. That affects the way you handle that moment. So the best information you get in the script is what the writer says about you. So if you read a script from the writer's perspective and they say he walk into a room, mug face, sullen, and his first line is, oh, I'm so hungry. You know exactly the emotion to put on that line when you say it. You know what I mean? So you have the three different perspectives of how you read the script. Then once I feel like I have a grasp, an idea of the emotional state of the character, I find a piece of art, I find a song, and I find clothing that I feel capture the essence of the character. I buy a piece of art for every movie I do.
What was what was your, in terms of, you know, you talk about finding yourself inside a character, where were you in your character for The Hurt Locker?
You know what? The Hurt Locker, that's a great question. Mm-hmm. Hurt, the Hurt Locker was interesting because for me, the racial dynamic played everything about that. Mm-hmm. You have a black soul just trying to make it home to his family, who's trying to make it home, who's trying to make his life better so he can use his GI Bill and go to college. That's the way I played it. That's the character I developed because he wanted to go to engineering school. Because if you look at bomb techs, they're very smart guys. I mean, these guys go to MIT. To be. Georgia Tech, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So he's a dude who went to undergraduate school, a state school, went, became a bomb tech, and now he's hoping to get back home so he can go to MIT or, you know, Georgia Tech and become an engineer so he can do better for his family. That's when he don't have the privilege to come and goof off and do all this shit mm-hmm. like the white dude does.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and once again, it's an example of a white dude getting privilege just simply because of who he is.
Yeah.
So yeah. that arrogance, that dynamic of frustration is what pushed Sanborn to the point where he was like, I might just kill this motherfucker. If it stands between me and him going home, I will kill him.
How much of that, for that particular movie, how much of that is you bringing to it versus what Catherine is like kind of directing you to do?
Oh, that was 100% my Juilliard experience.
Hey.
That's what's up.
Oh, yeah. When I read that script, I was like, oh, this Juilliard.
Yeah.
I'm getting my ass kicked and bust and working my fucking ass up, laying under a piano so I can work on tuning my ears so I can hear different accents and sounds. And this motherfucker ain't even bringing scenes in class. He's the lead of the play. He's the lead. And I never got a lead my entire time was there. The only time I got a lead when I was at Juilliard was when I created it.
Mm.
I get it. Fool me one time, shame on you.
What was the song? What was your song for Hurt Locker? What was it? Do you remember?
You know what it was?
Or your piece of art or whatever.
Yeah.
What was it? The piece of art, I got a Jacob Lawrence painting called Funeral Procession, which literally took my whole Hurt Locker check. It's art. You can't not buy.
No, I've seen that painting. I know that. Yeah. I know that one.
You know, I got a piece called Funeral Procession because, you know, when I looked at that piece and I thought about the dignity of this man coming home and his mama taking him to church and saying, look, my baby made it through the war.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how important is that to a soldier for his mama to see her baby coming up the driveway?
Man.
You know?
Oh, yeah. So, it's the famous, the one that was in the Cosby.
Yeah.
The
it's like you said,
the Huxtable's house. Right. It was at the Huxtable's house. Yeah. It was a whole episode on it. Okay. Sorry.
And, the song, I can't remember the song. I remember it was a Tupac song because all I listened to was Tupac. But I can't remember which one it was. I'm sure it had a, you know, motherfucker kick ass shit. No, something about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
You said, man, enemies, Hennessy.
Hennessy.
Yo. Man, I wish they would have known. I wish they would have said something because in the marketing for Notorious, because when I saw Notorious, and I mean, I had seen you in a lot of stuff prior to that, but I was like, yo, why did they cast Anthony Mackie as Pop? Like, that didn't make sense to me
until
at the time.
They gave you the backstory. Yeah.
Yeah, but now that I'm hearing this, I'm like, damn, why didn't they make
they
that
mentioned
kind
it
of,
a little bit in the press, but not
to give
as
us
much
some context.
Should. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because that would have set it up, that would have set you up so much better, in my opinion, just to give context as to why you were playing that role.
The interesting thing about Tupac, because my first job, like I said, I played Tupac off Broadway.
Right.
And his mama came and his sister came and all his boys came. They were like, yo, you killed that shit. So when they said that, nobody else's opinion mattered. Like the biggest thing I got from people about Notorious was he don't look like Tupac. And I'm like, if that's the only thing you can say, then I won, fool.
Yeah.
I won. If you can say, oh, he was good, but he don't look like Tupac, though. All right, fine. You go cast somebody that look like Tupac and see how that works.
But can't act, right?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And they do that so much. Like, they cast people that can sing and can't act. And then you see the movie, and it's like, damn. Like, why didn't they just cast somebody who could act and dub the singers?
You're right.
Yep.
You're right.
You know? If all of us was Jennifer Hudson, she wouldn't be special.
Can you talk about the process that led up to what I'm assuming is your first film, which is 8 Mile?
Yeah.
At the time when it was presented to you,
Papa Doc.
Yeah, at the time when it was presented to you, did you think that this would be Oscar caliber and critically acclaimed? Because even when I heard about the rumors of 8 Mile happening, I think in my mind I just filed it in the kind of somewhere in between Dr. Dre's The Wash and
Purple Rain.
Yeah, and the missing Beastie Boys film.
Soul Plane. No, well,
yeah, I just meant at the time, it's just like, oh, Eminem's doing a movie. Okay, cool. But, you know, I was shocked that, you know, everyone, I was shocked that it was great. So, you know, what was the process of you getting the role, like the audition process and all those things?
The ironic thing was, so I had just got out of school. My first movie I did was this movie called Brother to Brother, which to me is some of the best acting, or the best acting I've done in my career, which is sad to say because it was my first fucking movie. But
no, I'm going to ask you about that. I'm going to ask you about that. Go ahead.
When I was doing Tupac off Broadway at New York Theater Workshop, and this woman, Molly Finn, God rest her soul, one of the best casting agents in the business, came to see the play because she was doing a movie about hip hop. She came backstage afterwards and was like, you know, I want you to audition for the movie. She called my agent. I go in for Curtis Hanson. So when I read the script was very different than the way it is in the movie. The script was very, very different. Like Scott Silver, we completely rewrote that script. Eminem and Makai completely rewrote that script every day before we walked on set. But it became his truth. You know, everything about that movie was truth. Even his battle against me, calling me Clarence, because my parents had a good marriage.
Clarence's parents had a real good marriage.
I went to private school. so
he just used those facts from your actual life against you?
And wrote a rap about it.
Wow.
That's why I was so mad at the end. I was like, am I going to have to sneak Eminem on stage?
And you didn't know that he had written that before. You didn't know it until you heard it.
No, he came up to me before and he was like, yo, you know, I just wanted to warn you, like, there's no reason for me not to like your character. Like, your character's a cool dude. Like, you a cool dude. I was like, thanks, him. He was like, so, you know, I went online, got some stuff. And, you know, I wrote a rap. Hey, babe, I wrote a rap. And, you know, I'm going to do it when we, you know, get on stage. I was like, hey,
that was your warning.
Dope.
That's all you get.
Wow.
That's it.
Yo. Then he opened his fucking mouth. And I was like, this motherfucker.
How many takes was that?
One. Because the crazy thing about the rap battle scene, Eminem was sick. So he couldn't do a lot of takes. So he literally did it in one take. And then after that, it was just like him lipping it and like doing the motions.
Oh, okay.
And they would play it back on the speaker. But the shit he did like that, and a lot, anybody will tell you, when we did that rap battle scene, they literally brought in like 300 people in this stage they built. And they were
St. Andrews, right? St. Andrews in Detroit?
It was supposed to be the St. Andrews, but this was a room that they built on a stage.
Okay.
Right. So they bring us in there, and everybody there was like a budding rapper. So everybody was looking at me like, yo, why the fuck they cast this dude to play a rapper? We gonna fuck him up when we rap. And I'm like, we're acting, sir. So we're acting. Curtis Hanson was like, yo, you know, we need some B-roll of people rapping against Eminem so we can see him working his way up the ladder of beating people. So we're going to, you know, we need 6 of you guys to come up and freestyle against him. He's not going to say anything because he's feeling kind of under the weather. We just need footage of you like rapping against him. So these 6 motherfuckers got up, and the first dude got up and was like, blah, 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 you suck, blah, blah, blah. And the audience was like, yeah, go, yeah. Second person got up and it was a little chick. And the little chick gave Eminem his lunch.
Ooh.
And when she finished, the crowd went crazy. It was like a rap. It was the Apollo in this motherfucker. It was crazy. So then Eminem looked at the crowd and looked at her and was like, nah, fuck this. He turned his mic on. And you see the little girl face like, what are you doing? You're not supposed to, what are you doing? Yo, and off the dome, he destroyed. I mean,
better him.
Literally, he finished this girl to a point. I'm sure she went and became a nurse and gave up.
We never heard from her again.
Never heard of her. And then the next dude gets up and he's like, oh shit. Eminem's mic is okay. Eminem, I like your rhymes. You are cool.
So wait, when they were doing B-roll, were they addressing him as Rabbit, but just kind of subtly using Eminem references that, you know?
Exactly. They were talking about, because, you know, they were talking about him as Eminem, but they were like, yo, you know, when you talk about him, you know, talk about him as Rabbit, not as Eminem. So they're like, all right, cool. Because, you know, all these dudes are really talented rappers. So they were just coming off their head, like, with freestyle shit. Man, when this motherfucker turned his mic on.
That was it.
It was ill. It was done. Game over. Cut the
chain. Did you not fear, but were you concerned that you actually had to prep as a freestyle MC to nail this role?
Man, I'll tell you, like I told Curtis Hanson, I was like, you give me a week, I can fly a helicopter.
I believe that.
So he was like, because when I first got the role, this is what was funny. I only had four lines and three scenes, and I was only supposed to be there a week. And the longer I was there, Curtis started developing the role because we got along together so well. He started giving me more scenes. Then he was like, yo, can you stay longer? I was like, hell yeah, I ain't got no job. So I literally stayed there. And then he comes up to me one day and he's like, yo, Anthony, can you rap? And I'm like, yep.
I played Tupac and I went to Juilliard.
Sure. I'm like, can you rap? Can they read Shakespeare? No. Thank you very much. Fuck out of here.
Right.
So wait, you wrote your rhyme during that battle?
No, there was this freestyle rapper named Craig G.
Craig G. Yeah, he was the one that did.
And oh, Craig G wrote that?
Yeah, no, we worked together. And okay. I gave him some shit and he took it and made it into a rap. Because when I did it, it was like, Yo,
like, check it.
Yo, that shit'll get you killed in a battle. You gotta come right off. You gotta come right off with it.
It's like not jumping like in a double dutch roll.
Wait, can I ask Monte, is yo, the black version of, well, my name is done and I'm here to say?
Here to say, right? Right. It's straight up stalling, bro. Stalling. Yo, you got to get to the smoke.
I said, yo, check it for like 16 bars, bro. And this motherfucker was like, all right, sit down. But he really, you know, we sat down for like 45 minutes and really crafted some shit where I could get, you know, grimy and emotional with it and really show like the skills of Papa Doc as a battle rapper, as a freestyle rapper. And you know, so I owe it all to him. I mean, if it wasn't him, I would have looked like booty up there.
Okay. All right. So I have a question about Brother to Brother. So, of course, now in 2020 or 2021, we're slowly becoming more evolved when dealing with people who are culturally different than the rest of the world. Your character was a homosexual in this film. So, you know, I remember distinctly an interview that Will Smith gave in which he said that Denzel told him
playing gay would end his career.
Right. He gave him a warning about 6 degrees and said that, you know,
yep,
be careful how you play this role because this could destroy your career. Where,
right,
you know, of course now, again, we're inching towards being evolved as humans in 2021. But back in 2004, we weren't quite there. So how difficult or hard was it to accept this role as the first? So technically you're saying that this is the first movie that you made, even though 8 Mile came out first?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, so I asked for that role. The young man, Rodney Evans, who wrote Brother to Brother, he offered me the role of the poet that was played by Larry Gilliard because he felt like he needed a gay man to play the gay role. Mm-hmm. And he was like, you play Tupac. There's no way you can play a gay character.
What? I went to Juilliard. Yeah.
So I said, right. I literally said, I went to Juilliard. I read a scene for him and he was like, all right, I'll give you the role. You can play the role. And you know what was weird? Like when I was in school, I realized that I was a sexist homophobic.
Yeah, a whole black man in the 90s.
Yeah, what made you realize that?
There was this actor my freshman summer. I went to Chautauqua, New York to do a Shakespeare. And I said something stupid about my gay teacher. And this other actor came up to me and set me straight. You know, I just felt like less than a human being for even looking at thinking it was okay to look at another human being that way just because of their sexual preference. And I was ashamed. I was literally ashamed of myself. And it took me those 3 years to exorcise that demon. And the culmination of that was when I read Brother to Brother. I was like, look, if I'm an actor, you know, I need to play this role so that I can understand the day-to-day struggles of what a young gay black man goes through.
And did that role help you understand that?
100%. It changed my life. It changed my perspective on life.
So talk about that in relation to your Black Mirror episode, Striking Vipers, because that was like next level. It was decades afterwards.
Yeah, that episode went in a direction I did not expect.
And it did. But I was so here for it because it was, I mean, it's Black Mirror, so it always makes you think differently and it always makes you think this shit could happen. So, and I was here for these two black men having this beautiful moment. I don't know. What are you saying?
Well, the idea of Striking Vipers, which was so funny, is the quintessential romance. Every dude would agree, when you out with your boys and you having a good time and your girl call you like, fuck, give me a minute. And you run outside, jump in the car.
Oh, no, but at the top, it's just, hey, babe, we're out having fun with my boys.
Right. I'm just chilling. And then she's like, come home. You're like, damn, I don't want to leave my boys because I'm having so much fun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's the same thing with Striking Vipers. It's just they took it in a virtual sense. And the funny thing about it was when I read for Striking Vipers, it was supposed to be two white dudes. Then the director was like, maybe it could be a white dude and a black dude. And then once the director was like, I've been angry of homosexuality in the black community. Wouldn't we fuck people up if we do it with two black dudes?
Yes, yes.
And I was like, yes, you would. And he's like, I think black people need to see this. And I was like, yes, they do.
Yes.
No. So it was literally this little white European director who was like, yo, I'm putting this shit out there on blast.
Yo, and the two actors, and it's so dope too, because it couldn't have been two perfect actors, you and Yaya, like, especially the perception and the roles that y'all have already played in the past. So that's why that reaction from Fonte was probably how everybody felt, because they would have never imagined these two actors.
I didn't see that episode going in that direction.
Was sitting in the airport, and there was a dude sitting across from me playing his little Nintendo Switch, right? So he's playing his Switch, and he looks up and he sees my face, and he's like, "Oh!" He turned his Switch off and put it in his bag.
Cause not for nothing. Have you heard any feedback from any, especially gay black men? I have a gay black brother that talks about this episode. He's a fan. He's a big Marvel head anyway. So he's an Anthony Mackie fan. But for him, it meant something different as well. So I was curious if you got any feedback about that.
You know,
Time out. Margaret, you have a brother?
A black, you know, my play brother.
Oh, black people. Like, all right, go ahead. Sorry.
Lies, man. We all
lie. Re-ask the question. I'm sorry.
Wolf tickets and shit.
No, it was just 5 years into the show. I'm like, wait a minute. You have a brother?
You have a sibling? Right.
No, all only children got a bunch of fake brothers and sisters. That's just what we do. Sorry.
I only claim my own. Good.
And that's why I did the episode, because I expected that. Like, I expected the conversation, the acknowledgement, the feedback, the appreciation. And I haven't got that at all.
Okay, if they love it.
If anything, I've gotten the direct opposite.
What you mean?
Oh, my God.
Are black people watching Black Mirror?
Yes.
Yeah. That's why it's called Black Mirror.
You ain't seen at least the Black Museum. That was the whole Black Museum season. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But what was the other reaction that you've been getting?
Just like, you know, a lot of negative.
No.
Oh yeah. It's interesting. The connotation of, you know, negative feedback as far as, you know, questioning if one, I was gay, you know, their opinion of what homosexuality was, their opinion of what, you know, it means, which is something I definitely expected and was ready to question and strike down as soon as that conversation came up. But I was just surprised by the fact that, you know, I went out there and like nobody had my back.
Oh, I got you.
No. Yeah. I know there are people out there that do.
Yeah.
But there's been times where, you know, you got to let somebody know that you're in the gym and you bench pressing 225, 15 times.
Yeah.
There's been a few instances like that, you know?
Yeah.
Wow. I did not know. Wow.
I felt the weight of that role, especially for you.
No, I really liked that episode. I didn't think there would be any negative feedback.
No,
that.
It was a great experience.
Yeah.
All right, before we get to She Hate Me, I do have to briefly ask, even though it wasn't a major role, but could you talk about Manchurian Candidate and sort of like the process of doing that, and how was that for you?
Manchurian was hell on earth, dude. I mean, I was only there a few days because I was doing another movie, and I literally did it just because I wanted to work with Jonathan Demme.
Right.
You know, being an actor in New York, Jonathan Demme was at the, you know, a god, like a thing of folklore and legend. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when he, because he knew me from theater and independent films in New York. So he was like, you know, I'm doing this little movie, you know, Denzel said yes, so I have another role for you. I'm like, all right, cool. So, you know, he brought me out. He was really good at casting people he liked to be around, people he considered friends. So it was more so the experience just to be on set with him and see him direct. Mm-hmm. But they didn't tell us we was going to be in New Jersey in 2 feet of snow in fucking January.
Oh, shit.
Trying to act like we were in the desert in shorts and t-shirts.
Sounded like somebody from NO.
I see.
Yeah.
Hey, take it.
Okay.
Couldn't take it at all.
Also, before we,
I don't have a lot. Oh my God, I don't have.
I just wanted before because I know you about to go in. Half Nelson, man, that's one of my favorite roles of yours.
Thank you, sir.
I thought that script was very. It was a chance. I mean, it was risky. You know what I mean? Because it could be interpreted in a lot of different ways. But tell me about that role and like working with like Ryan Gosling, and what was it like shooting that?
You know, Half Nelson was dope. We literally shot that belly of Brooklyn. And, you know, working with Ryan at that time was interesting because he wasn't Ryan Gosling. Mm-hmm. You know, so he was taking chances and doing things in a different type of way. There was a different understanding of the way he was working, you know? And that movie made him, put him on the map. And, you know, for me, growing up in New Orleans, like, the drug dealers I knew were the ones who took care of the neighborhood. They took care of the block. So if you were a smart kid with good grades and you come out and you're like, yo, I want to sell rocks. They're like, nah, get the hell on. Get on. This ain't for you. You know? So when I read that script, I talked to the producer and Ryan Anna, who directed it. And I was like, this is like, if he's taking care of this little chick and making sure that she's, you know, provided for and taken care of in a situation where she has no one, you know, he's that dude that take care of the block. He's providing jobs and economic structure for his community when the government has basically bastardized them and condemned them to nothing. So that was something I predicated on that role and wanted to, you know, grow and mature that character into because I knew those dudes. I grew up with those dudes. You know, when I wanted a pair of Jordans and my mama wouldn't buy me Jordans, like, you know, my dude on the corner made sure that we had Jordans. Like when I had to take the bus at 5:30 to make it to school by 8, my dude on the corner made sure I didn't get beat up on my way to the bus.
Oh, wow.
You know, so the drug dealers literally found out I was a little arson dude and they took care of me. I never got jumped on the way home.
Wow.
because if you stepped on if you stepped in Boscoville and tried to steal up on me, them boys was there ready. you wouldn't come in the Boscoville talk.
Listen, I don't have a lot of, we had Spike Lee on the show. I told him She Hate Me was always an interesting movie for me, just from the storyline of you and the ladies and impregnating them.
I said that was Spike's midlife crisis.
I agree with you. I agree with you. and so did his wife and his daughter. But listen, my question to you about She Hate Me, outside of the draw of this phenomenal cast, because it should not be forgotten that Lynette McGee, Jim Brown, Ozzie Davis, Wendell.
Everybody
was in this movie, because I know that was a draw. But really, tell me, Anthony Mackie, when you read this script the way you do with your three layers.
Did you read it three times?
What was the real draw of this script?
To be honest, Jeffrey Wright was offered She Hate Me, and he turned it down.
Really?
It was Dario Dawson and Jeffrey Wright.
Whoa.
And,
wow.
Yeah, and they said no.
I didn't want to see him in that physical position like you.
I was working with Spike on, so I hold the record of being the lead of two Spike Lee movies nobody saw.
Oh,
so the movie I was working was on with Spike, it was called Sucker Free City. It was a movie we did for
I totally forgot about that one. But I saw that.
So when we were doing Sucker Free City, Spike was like, man, I got this movie, boom, boom, boom. It's going to be crazy. You know, Jeffrey Wright, Mos Def, boom, 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 Rosario Dawson. I'm like, bet, let me know when you need me. So two weeks later, he comes back. He's like, yo, my next project, would you be interested in doing it?
Yeah, man.
I'm like, hell yeah, I'd be interested in doing it. So the crazy thing was, when I read the script, to me, because of Michael Genet wrote it, it read like a Shakespearean play. If you read a Shakespearean play, you have plot, subplot, you have four different storylines, and they all culminate into one story. If you look at She Hate Me, it's really Shakespearean in the way it's written, because you have plot, subplot, you have two or three different storylines.
You and do. Crazy, I got that.
And the crazy thing about it is, people say it was Spike's middle age crisis. You know what was the cover of the New York Times Magazine the week She Hate Me came out?
What?
Looking for Mr. Good Sperm. Women over 40 paying young men for sperm instead of going to sperm banks.
But they weren't lesbians, Anthony.
And these women were rich lesbians in the New York Times Magazine. And what was
not even connected? Not even connected?
Not at all. Not connected at all. And what was crazier, this was the same time that doctor had impregnated like 150 women with his own sperm.
Yeah, with his own shit. Yeah. Mm.
Y'all was topical.
It was timely. It was timely.
Yeah.
Even the subplots with the embezzlement and stuff like that. Yeah. But it was just
so. It's easy to say that's, you know, a midlife crisis of a man or a man's dream and a sexist connotation that men disrespect and bastardize women. But the reality of it is, it was very timely and on point.
That's a nice translation. Very well done.
My lady.
Juilliard.
Wrapping it up in a nice little box.
I mean, I think, too, in that movie, too, I mean, they were, the thing I liked about it, I mean, both parties, they were making a choice. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
wasn't, you know what I mean? It wasn't like there was this guy that, like you said, homie, that was just giving women his own shit unknowingly and with them, without their knowledge or whatever. Both parties were consenting that this is what they wanted to do.
We live in a day and age where consent is okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's mandatory.
It's preferred.
Right.
Preferred.
You know,
it's the law.
It's preferred. Law, right? Yeah,
consent
is okay.
There are a lot of aspects of me that enjoyed that movie. I just, you know.
What did you didn't like about it, Laia?
It was just always odd to me that this man was having physical sex and they were enjoying it, and these women were not queer women. They were supposed to be like straight up lesbians. So I was like, do they not just ask this man for a turkey baster? Where they do that? But I enjoyed.
There's so much I can say about that. Is it Anthony?
Was the original. Was the original script what wound up on the final cut, or were there adjustments made, or?
Well, for She Hate Me?
Yeah.
No, that was pretty much the original script. I mean, when I came on board, Michael Genet had to change some things. But for the most part, that was the script I read. I mean, it was pretty, you know, when Spike comes on board, he does his Spike-isms. But, you know, it was pretty much the script I read.
No, this is why I love your journey. Like, I loved watching your acting journey because, I don't know, every role stood out and every role had a meaning and it was deeper than you thought. Same thing that you're doing right now with the Falcon, because I was like, it's ill that the Falcon is getting a little deep. I was like, I like you know what I'm saying? You put a little Anthony on the Falcon.
Yeah, man. Yeah, we got to talk about, like, how did you come into the Marvel Universe? I mean, we know, like, the your boy Terrence Howard, he originally was...
No, that was Don.
No, right? That was Don. Don, that's right. That was Don, yeah. Right.
It was Terrence in Iron Man 1. And then Don stepped in Iron Man 2.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he became War Machine. But so how did your journey come into it?
You know, my Marvel experience was very different. They came to me and I was asking them to be a part of the Marvel Universe around the time of Iron Man 2, Iron Man 3. And then they asked me to come out to L.A. to have a meeting. And literally we had lunch and they said, OK, we can't tell you what movie, we can't tell you what character, but if we asked you to be in the Marvel Universe, would you do it?
And you said,
and I said, would you want to tell them about that gun line, boss?
The state of Mississippi.
In a dream world, though, Anthony, I mean, I'm sorry, but who would you have wanted to? Did you have a preference?
Just say it.
Did you want Black Panther?
No. I mean, anybody.
No. For me, it was either, because I didn't think they were going to bring the Falcon into the fold.
Right.
For me, when I was harassing them, I was harassing them about Black Panther, because I thought that was, for me, if you look up any press I did before they even announced it, I said very specifically that the movies they should do was Black Panther and Wonder Woman.
Oh, yes.
Ah, okay.
Gotcha. Oh.
Because little brown boys and girls need representation.
How steeped were you into the universe of Marvel before you actually got involved in the film?
Not at all. I was never a comic book kid. Like, that's why it's so funny to me.
Neither.
That's why it's so funny to me now when people say, oh, I'm a nerd, I freak. I'm like, if everybody was reading comic books, why did all the comic book stores go out of business? So stop fucking lying. You are reading comics.
The movies. They sell Betty and Veronica in the grocery stores, too. But
yeah, nobody was reading fucking comic books.
Yeah, I got to admit, Aunt. I did. In my 5-year history of this show, I was nervous about you coming on only because I know that there's a contingent or at least a certain fan base, you know, those in San Diego, what do you call them? Comic-Conners.
Oh, Comic-Con.
Comic-Con, yeah.
That are so deep into the shit. And it's not like I'm not a Marvel head. I just didn't grow up reading comic books and whatnot. I knew nothing about the Marvel. I didn't know it that deep. And I was afraid. I was like, yo, if I have him on the show and don't ask him some deep Easter egg question that...
It's okay. I have notes. What do you need? Because I want you to hurry up and get to your question because I got some Marvel notes.
You have to look at Comic-Con.
I wish I could block lie you right now.
Good. You can.
You have to look at Comic-Con this way. Every year, you know, 10 to 15,000 people go to San Diego for Comic-Con. How many people are in America?
Very true. But Anthony, don't you agree there are levels of these people? Like, it's not just Comic-Con or Amir. There are, like, at least 10 different levels in between Comic-Con and Amir of Marvel.
Right, 100%. But yeah. I'm saying the whole thing of, you
well,
know,
well, I'm not
now,
at the bottom. I see these films.
Now, everybody saying. You talk to grew up reading true. Comic books and knowing everything. I'm like, that's not true. That's not true.
No, it's not true.
Like, people get mad
at everyone has the internet now.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Right.
Yeah,
they got the internet true. Now. You that's can go back true. And read. You right. can become a retroactive comic book fan. It's
right.
Like,
or just read on the Wikipedia comic right. pages.
Yeah, so you read Reddit, nigga.
Yeah, because, you know, dudes show up, they see the chick dressed as Leia at Comic-Con. You know, and they're trying to impress her by telling her about the Captain America Truth series. It's like, come on, stop it. Stop it. Stop it.
But what is that process like? Like doing, like living up to an expectation of, you know, having to go to Comic-Con and meet these, you know, these Trekkie-like nerds and whatnot. Like, is it exhausting? Like, do you have to do it? in the Marvel world? Or
yeah, you definitely have to do it. You know, but the big thing is, it feels good to be appreciated. You know, there's so many as artists. How many times have you created something and put it out there, and you know, no one has reacted or responded to it? Yeah. Or even worse, you put something out there and a motherfucker who's never made an album, a motherfucker who has no talent whatsoever, say your shit sucks.
Right.
You know, so it feels good. Imagine every time you put something out, you know, a motherfucker like, yo, this is the best shit ever.
Yeah, but okay, I have my version of Comic-Con, and that's called OK Player.
Yeah,
so,
but that ain't Comic-Con.
For real.
Yeah, no, but it's like, it's there's a danger in that. I feel like there's a danger. I know you're saying that it's great to be loved and appreciated and da-da-da-da, but then I just see Comic-Con people as like extreme level of nerdness and...
Not all.
Like
not
OK
all.
Player?
Like OK Player.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Just music nerds is just different.
It's inside baseball, man.
Yeah, so that's what it is. So,
but, I mean, it's also the thing where on OK Player, you know... there's equal amount of hate and disdain and criticism for the Roots and Questlove as there is love, probably more than so.
Yeah. Well, for Marvel folks, I think it's more about the writers and which directions they go in with the characters. And that's when the fans get mad, depending on if they that's go off script. Mm-hmm. So right. That's how it works for them. That being said, Anthony, can I ask you, one of my Marvel heads wanted me to ask you, do you think that the world was ever ready for a Black Captain America?
What his role was. I think the idea of, you know, was the world ever ready for a Green Hulk?
Right.
You know, it was never, how could you accept a green dude and not accept a black dude? You know, it was never.
I guess because it's Captain America is such an institution and the way he's looked at is different than a Black Panther. You know what I mean?
You know what? I'll be honest. Yeah. I think, like, especially being, do you have kids?
No. Okay. I know some, though.
Okay. One thing I know about kids and one thing I admire, kids aren't racist.
Yeah.
Like, they're pretty open-minded. We teach them racism.
Right.
So if you're making a comic book for kids about a character, no matter what color he is, if he has cool powers, they're going to love him.
Right. Yeah. But that's assuming that they make all these things for kids. Like, at this point, Marvel's an institution, right?
Wait. But the key phrase, at this point.
At this point.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So, you know, before, you know, it was cool to be a quote unquote nerd before, you know, Comic-Cons and people dressing up and doing cosplay, you know, books for teenagers and kids, you know, so if you present them with a Black Captain America, they'll grow up with a Black Captain America.
True.
And they don't know any different.
They wouldn't know any different. So how could they not be ready for something they don't even know? They wouldn't know anything, as opposed to Black Captain America. What? Because nobody complained when they made Captain British America.
You're right. Yo, I always want to ask you about Pain and Gain. Pain and Gain, bro. Like, how much did you have to like put on for that? Like, what was your training regimen like for that?
Now, I put on like I went up to about 220.
Okay.
So I was 195 before I started training for that. And I just literally ate steak and potatoes in the morning and 6 eggs and oatmeal for breakfast. And it was, dude.
That was just breakfast?
Six eggs and oatmeal with berries for breakfast. And then lunch, I would do like a mass gainer protein shake with a steak and some eggs. And then I would have like 4 more meals because I was eating like 3,500 calories a day.
Good God. Man, what was that experience like? I like that movie. I think I might be one of the only people that actually went up for that movie. I fuck with that movie. But but what was it like working with Mark and The Rock?
It was great, man. You know what? Mark is one of the coolest dudes I've ever worked with. And, you know, he really gave me an opportunity with that joint. We had a great time. Like, we literally every day came to set, shot the shit, had fun. I mean, it was, you know, Michael Bay gave us the keys to the car and was like, be as ridiculous as you want to be.
Wow.
I was going to ask you on some insider Marvel baseball on a season 2 episode with the older black man and the young black man. I heard those are actual Marvel characters. I was just going to ask you if that was going to develop into something.
I don't know, but Isaiah Bradley, a lot of people
Isaiah.
Yeah. Right. A lot of people don't know that the Super Soldier Serum was originally tested on Tuskegee soldiers. And it was a comic book that came out in the early 2000s called The Truth Series. And Isaiah Bradley it was a limited run. People like talk shit about it, so it went away. But the writer name was Morales. And he created this cartoon series where basically Isaiah Bradley and a bunch of Tuskegee soldiers were being injected with the super soldier serum so that they can perfect it. And once they perfected it, they gave it to Steve Rogers.
Wow. And so the rumor is that the grandson is going to become a young Avenger.
That's from the comic book.
Okay.
One thing you have to realize, Marvel never takes the comic books word for word, note for note.
Okay.
So even if you look at the comic book, when Falcon first was introduced, he was a hustler from Harlem. You know, so if you watch the movie, the Falcon's from Louisiana. Right. So, you know, it's a completely different world. It's a completely different universe. So it's not something where they take the comic book word for word or note for note.
And have you put any Anthony into any of these storylines?
No.
Okay.
Not at all.
Okay.
Because I didn't, you know, Malcolm Spellman, our writer, you know, him and the Marvel crew and Carrie, our director, they were the ones who came up with the storyline and ideas. That one came to me and was like, this is what we're thinking.
Okay.
So, you know, it wasn't me.
Man. It's dope.
I have two questions and then we'll let you go. One is about just the secretive process in the Marvel world. How airtight or Fort Knox-like is the process of actually getting the physical script? Like, do they have to, like, hand deliver it to you? Like, is it?
Yo, it's so crazy. No matter
what. Like, what happens if you lose your briefcase or something?
Yeah.
No matter where you are in the world, they send someone to come to you. You sign a letter saying that you received it. That person turns around, goes back to the airport, gets on the airplane, and flies back to LA.
Wow. Oh, that's it. Okay. My final question is, are you going to do any forays into directing?
Actually, I'm working on that now. There's this story that I'm acquiring the rights to about this young girl during civil rights who was the first woman to sit on a bus and not get up.
Call that Colvin?
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Fonte.
Nice.
Fonte knows his shit. It.
Yeah.
Oh man, before we go, I have to deliver this message to be mad. Omar Dorsey wanted me to ask you, why does everyone? You already know. He said, "Why does everybody call you an asshole, but they love him?"
Because Omar out here selling his booty for cornbread.
Drop, nigga.
Yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you.
Well,
that is another episode of Questlove Supreme with Anthony Mackey on behalf of Team Supreme.
You got dunked on, bro. You got dunked on. Oh, I'm sorry.
And all the cornbread in the world. Thank you, Anthony Mackey.
Flowers, Anthony. Flowers. Flowers. Yes.
We will see you in the next round, Questlove Supreme. I'll see y'all later.
Get your wolf ticket.
Hey, this is Sugar Steve. Make sure you keep up with us on Instagram at QLS and let us know what you think and who should be next to sit down with us. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.